We're here at Menards Bag Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint.
Batteries.
Tools.
Toilet paper.
Extension cords. Grocery items.
Hardware for my cabinets.
Snack items. Crackers and some canned good stuff.
Shop vac supplies.
Toothpaste, cereal, coffee, dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
Hey, this is Jen Johans at FilmIntuition.com and FilmIntuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.
Welcome to a milestone that I never thought I would actually reach. This is the 250th episode of the podcast. When I kicked it off 5 years ago, yes, March 2025 marks its fifth anniversary, I had no idea that the world was about to go into lockdown and that so many people would be excited to talk. We were all craving human connection at that point. I've always kind of found people, my people, over the internet. Everyone wonders, how do you get such guests? Where did you meet your wonderful friends? And for me, it's just a meeting of the minds that mostly happened over Twitter. Unfortunately, that is no more. And just friends of friends on the internet. As horrible of a place that the internet can be, and my goodness, I feel like it's gotten much, much worse. I am very grateful for those bright spots and for creating something that I was passionate about. A little humble movie recommendation show that blossomed into something else. These wonderful conversations with people that I love, guests that I've been curious about and honored to have on my podcast, new friendships that have been made. Some of these people I can't imagine not being in my life. All came from something I put out, a labor of love on the internet that found you guys as well, all of the listeners. So I just want to say thank you so much from the bottom of my heart for that. And I hope for as long as I'm able to continue doing this, as long as it's both fun and I'm not overworked and who knows what's ahead in the future with finances and the government and everything, I just want to make sure that I'm putting out shows that you enjoy and I'll keep doing it. For as long as that is. So, Watch with Jen's 250th. I think you will dig this episode. I kind of hesitated. I wasn't sure if I should create something new, some sort of like, I don't know, retrospective of the show. But then I thought, my goodness, you know, the 300th episode will probably hit next year, and I'll want to do something special for that as well. So what better than this year when we all need a nice distraction from the chaos going on than to laugh, talk, and celebrate a film series that has brought so many people joy with a dear friend who I always get the biggest kick out of talking with. I always learn something. My buddy Peter Avellino. So behold the Pink Panther episode. I can't play the Henry Mancini score because of copyright. I'm always on the side of not wanting to try to sneak in some great music that has a copyright because I don't want any episode having to get taken down because we work really hard on them and I know that hopefully they will bring you happiness, smiles, and laughter. So here we go. Thank you guys so much for being here. Sincerely, take care. Well, I am so pleased to have back one of my dear friends, one of my first friends on film Twitter. Remember that before that site kind of blew up. And just a brilliant writer, one of the great essayists. If you haven't checked out his website, Mr. Peel's Sardine Liqueur, you need to do that. Peter Avellino, I am thrilled to be talking to you. How are you, my friend?
I'm very well. Thank you, Janet. Thank you for that. It's good to be back here.
It's great to be talking to you.
Yes. Peter and I have gotten to hang out a couple times when I've been in LA. It's always wonderful to see him. With Peter last summer, we went to the Vista and had the greatest time watching My Man Godfrey on the big screen. So, Peter, this is wonderful to have you back. This season we both kind of need a reprieve. Who doesn't right now? The world is really, dark. There's a lot of stuff happening. It's intense. So we thought, what better than to dive into a movie series that we both love? And we went with The Pink Panther. Peter is very knowledgeable about Blake Edwards. So I'd love to know your early relationship with this movie, with Edwards, and what you think of the series.
Well, I've been a big fan of Blake Edwards for a very long time, and it's the Pink Panther films were there when I was a young kid. Probably from before I even remember. I probably maybe part of it was that I latched onto it because it starred somebody named Peter. I don't know. I have a feeling I was taken to one of them, and I don't even remember it. I was that young. And as the years went on, I had this attachment to Blake Edwards films that I couldn't even really understand. Like I was too young for some of these movies, and I don't mean in a PG or R-rated way. They were just like not movies that were meant for kids. And yet there was something about them. There was something about when I was growing up in the 80s, I recognized that these were films that were had this sort of continuity to them, of continuity of interests, of approaches. And, back then it was like the directors who seemed to be known were like Spielberg and Lucas and that sort of thing. And this was somebody who I did not see articles written about in Time magazine. And in the 80s, when he was in his 60s, Blake Edwards was pumping them out one after another. Boom, boom. And so I had this, I still have this interest in 10 and SOB and things like that. And I have interests in even a few of his less successful movies. But the Pink Panther series is obviously a part of that. And it runs through so much of his career. I mean, his career ends with a Pink Panther movie, basically. And it goes all the way up to the 60s. I mean, nowadays, having a character reprise a role that he played in a movie 30 odd years ago is not that unusual thing. In the 90s, it kind of was kind of surprising to see somebody like Herbert Lom playing a role he first played in the 60s. But and his visual approach, his thematic approach, his thematic interests still intrigue me. There's still something for me to see each time I revisit 10 and SOB and a few other things. And revisiting the Panther films this time have reminded me like where they originally came from. It's a series that basically happened by accident. Because,
It was
the
supposed to be a
original
David Niven vehicle.
basically a David Niven vehicle, but it was also basically this, ski lodge, jewel heist kind of romp sort of thing.
Like
David
Top
Niven was
Copy or, yeah.
exactly, yeah. And Peter Ustinov was going to be playing the French detective. Ava Gardner was going to be playing his wife. All this fell
I
apart
know.
fairly shortly before shooting began. Peter Sellers, who Blake Edwards had never really met or worked with, had a hole in his schedule. It worked out, and they basically came up with this character. And
On the ride back from the airport, like he picked them up and they
that's what I
just
read,
clicked.
yeah. And he stole the movie. I mean, he stole the movie. And it's fascinating to me that they basically made a follow-up so soon after that. It's one of those weird things. The movies were not made back to back. Sellers did Strangelove after Pink Panther, and then I think The World Henry Orients, and then A Shot in the Dark. But it's something like in New York, they opened like 2 months apart. And it's impossible to imagine something like that, something resembling that happening these days. I don't know, two Ace Ventura movies opening within a couple of months of each other or something like that. And, Sellers obviously exploded from this. and the character exploded from this, and the name, the general identity of the Pink Panther kind of came from this as well, and the Pink Panther cartoon series, which is not something I know much about.
Yeah, I vaguely remember seeing it in the 80s, but I couldn't tell you much about it. No.
Sure. And it was, you know, I get the feeling, not that I was around them, that the movies were just kind of around in re-releases on television.
Yep.
They attempted to do another movie, which I did not revisit for this, called Inspector Clouseau with Alan Arkin. That was a flop. I saw it like 25 years ago. I barely remember.
I can't remember if I saw that film. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then when they went back to the series, you know, they had no intention of going back to it. They did one movie in between together called The Party, which is great.
Oh, I love that movie.
Oh, I love The Party too. Oh, I love, yes. I love it. The early 70s were a low point for both Edwards and Sellers in their career.
Yeah. And personally for Sellers, I mean, he had a very difficult off-screen life. Yes.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Very tumultuous. But, yeah.
But Edwards was having his movies taken away, his movies recut.
Yes.
And these were big flops. These were Darling Lily and things like that, and The Tamarind Seed. And one other thing is that, you know, they had this sort of love-hate relationship. You know, they would love each other at the start, and then Sellers would get into a bad mood halfway through the shoot.
Yeah.
And they would just wind up despising each other, and it would sort of go back and forth. And when they came together for Return of the Pink Panther, I think they were both willing to get along, because mm-hmm. they both saw that this could be good for them creatively, financially. Edwards had scripts he wanted to do instead, and did much later on, but right then this was what he was able to get made. And in the early 70s, you know, the word reboot was not a thing, but that's basically what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And even the idea of sequels with big stars were really just becoming into serious vogue at that point in time. I mean, you could compare the Pink Panther movies to the James Bond movies easily, especially in the 70s. They really do feel like this sort of comic equivalent of what the Roger Moore movies were at the time, because, you know, set in Europe, and, you know, they have famous theme songs, and they have recurring characters and recurring actors and elaborate title sequences. So they weird, the two series at that point in time weirdly kind of go together in life.
They do.
Yeah. But should we go back to the 60s films first?
I think so. Yeah. My relationship with the Pink Panther movies, I think I saw them on TV as a kid, but they didn't really register too much. I probably recognized the animated Pink Panther character more. And I remember seeing an interview with Drew Barrymore in the mid-90s when they were asking her what movies made her laugh. And she said something, I can't remember what the first one was, but she latched right on to Peter Sellers and the Pink Panther movies being like what she goes to when she's sick, and they just cheer her up and make her laugh. And the interviewer, I can't remember who, was kind of going through it. And I just thought, I need to see these. And thankfully, Turner Classic Movies played a huge array of the films, like the series on New Year's, I believe. Either it was New Year's or after Christmas. It was in that holiday time. So we recorded all of them. Those good old like Sony 8-hour or 9-hour tapes that I love. I used to record and fill those up so much. My parents kept having to buy more. And oh my goodness, I had the most fun watching these. I think, you know, Shot in the Dark and Pink Panther Strikes Again are my favorites. I lean more towards Strikes Again, but I think those two are the funniest, the best. But Pink Panther, yeah, we can start there with that first movie, the first time we saw him. He's more normal in this one, which is interesting because he gets more and more bumbling. The accent gets a little more exaggerated, and he really kind of comes into his own as it continues. So, yeah, I think we should start there, Pink Panther.
I'm sure that to this day there are people who see the Pink Panther for the first time, knowing the backstory of Clouseau and all that stuff, and are basically surprised to discover that he's not the lead character.
Yeah.
He basically disappears for about a half hour in the middle.
I know. It's a big ensemble movie, and it's a little long, I'll say. It goes on too long in some of the sequences, but, you know, when he's on, your eye is going right to him. When he's not on the screen, you're like, I want him back. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, David Niven is top billed, but it really is more of an ensemble thing as opposed to him being the lead of the movie. And although I would say that the tone of the entire series changes wildly when the focus becomes on Clouseau.
Oh, for sure.
The very tone of the first film feels like a David Niven kind of tone. It's a very
classic.
You know, going for elegance and lightness, and
yeah.
the Henry Mancini music, all set in a ski lodge, and then later on a big party in Rome. I was watching it the other night. I like the big party scene at the end. I think it's very well choreographed in terms of what's going on, where, and all that stuff. But yeah, the movie is absolutely in no rush whatsoever to go anywhere, especially in the long stretch when it's sort of David Niven trying to seduce Claudia Cardinale and all that stuff. It's not a movie that is racing. And then when Sellers finally shows up in the second half, things really do pick up with lots of bedroom shenanigans and stuff. I think it's very funny. I like the film. I think I've even liked it more as time goes on because I can accept it as this other, as this lark more than a Clouseau movie. There's a musical number sung by Fran Jeffries at around the halfway point when Clouseau reappears. It's just about my favorite scene in the movie, just because I like that kind of thing from 60s movies, I guess, where they just have a song for no reason whatsoever. And a lot of them, what Blake Edwards is interested in terms of slapstick and that sort of posh lifestyle, it's all put together very well. It's just not the comic explosion that was still to come.
Absolutely. Yeah. I read that David Niven at the Academy Awards, they were going to use the Pink Panther theme as his walkout music. And he actually requested the change. He said, no, that wasn't my movie. He acknowledged that, Sellers did take it over, and that is kind of a thing. And you do wonder if, I mean, he was a class act and a pro, and he had decades of success, but you do wonder what that was probably like for him going in thinking, this is a star vehicle, this is what I'm doing. And then some, young upstart, or younger, I should say, upstart, kind of steals his thunder a little bit. That happens a lot. I've heard stories from actors about some actors who became very famous, one or two of them in the Paul Thomas Anderson movies over the years, how they got their start kind of, they would be in the van just like doing lines, bit lines in movies, and then make whatever line they got in a film about them and, really take charge of that scene and give it their all, and they would steal focus. And that's what happens in this. Peter Sellers had done comedies over in England and been very, very funny, but he was, I think, newer to definitely American audiences and newer to some people around the world. And so I love that this is also a throwback to those 20s and 30s kind of silent comedians that, Blake Edwards and Peter Sellers adore. Kind of the physical approach. There's even a sequence in the movie that's like right out of Duck Soup. I think it's great. Yeah.
It's probably a very unusual experience to be David Niven in the 60s,
yes.
To be David Niven specifically, and be top billed in a movie that's a big hit. And the fact that it's a big hit is not really because of you. That's
exactly.
A high class problem, but it was probably an unusual feeling. It's an enjoyable movie that if you were going to show to somebody now, you kind of have to, if you're going to show somebody, you have to give them a few caveats about, okay, just
yes.
So you know, this is not all Peter Sellers. This is a light, frothy ski lodge kind of Jurassic thing. And
it's more of a caper film, like more of a traditional caper movie. Yeah. And I love the women in this, Cappuccino and Claudia Cardinale. I think they're so good. So funny. And just able, it does that British bedroom farce thing that's great, like noises off, or, you know, lots of doors slamming, people under beds, in closets, which I always enjoy. I love those kind of British sex comedies that you see on the stage. We had a theater back in Minnesota where I grew up called the Old Log Theater. And actually, it's where Nick Nolte was one of the people that got his start there. And they pretty much did mostly like those kind of plays. And they were always a riot. Yeah. So I liked that about this. Yes.
It's a very well done film. It's a very elegant film. It's a very funny film. It occurred to me, the first shot after the opening credits is just an establishing shot of Rome. And the movie goes back to that same shot at the very end of the movie when a car drives off and the end comes on screen. So it's sort of like this bookend kind of thing. And then there's an elegance to that. And if you were to compare that to A Shot in the Dark, it's almost like the elegance kind of, you know, totally goes away. Shot in the Dark actually does, Shot in the Dark does open with a very elegant sequence. But
yes,
by the end of the
movie,
it's
long and beautifully
long.
Done.
It's very well done. But at the end of the movie, that all dissolves into people screaming at each other.
Yeah,
so chaos. The elegance totally goes away. The tone of the Pink Panther, like I said, is a David Niven tone. Just think of the sound of his voice. That is basically the rhythm and tone of that movie. The
tone and rhythm, Peter. Yeah.
The tone and rhythm of A Shot in the Dark is madness. intentionally so. So Sellers totally takes it over as he was supposed to. And, you know, A Shot in the Dark was also basically like began as something else because it began as a successful Broadway play that I've never read or seen. I don't know it. I know William Shatner was in it. I know Walter Matthau was in it, but I don't know anything about it beyond that. And basically it was being turned into a movie. And then the director left, Sophia Loren left, Blake Edwards came in, he asked to rewrite it, he had the idea to bring back Clouseau. I guess he knew the lightning in the bottle that they had, even at the last stage. And they just sort of went from there and rewrote it and turned it into a full-blown Clouseau movie, which is a much darker, more cynical comedy.
Kind of a a little bit bluer is what the reviewers were writing at the time, yes.
It's a little bit bluer. All of the wealthy people at the ski lodge and the party in the Pink Panther, they're all la-di-da type stuff. They're all pleasant and, you know, we don't really think much about them, but they're all rich people living their own world. And that's fine and all this stuff. In A Shot in the Dark, all the rich people are just awful people.
Yes.
Awful. Anything that happens to them by the end of the movie, nobody cares. It's nobody's worried about that. It's an awful place. They're ridiculously wealthy, opulence and all this stuff. We don't care about any of them. They're awful. And Elke Sommer is like the one innocent in the middle of all that. I'm not even sure she's all that innocent. Actually.
No.
But, but nevertheless, it's a movie where that is very much about, you know, discovering in a sane world that the only way to succeed, the only way to the truth is through total madness. And it drives that. This is Herbert Lom's. Are we moving on to A Shot in the Dark here? I sort of did that without.
No, I think that's perfect. Yeah.
Okay. Shot in the Dark, which along with everything I said is, you know, Clouseau is fully the lead character. It's the series debut of several other actors in there, including Herbert Lom and Graham Stark and Burke Kwok. And Henry Mancini continues to do the music. There is no Pink Panther theme because it's not a Pink Panther movie. But it's from the same producers, it sort of has that same 60s European feel to it, even though it was made under different circumstances. It is the first, is the first real Clouseau film. It is the first film where Clouseau is driving somebody insane. It is the first film. There's no body count in The Pink Panther. There's a sizable body count in A Shot in the Dark.
Yeah.
It's the first film where it's the first film with Cato. It's the first film where Commissioner Dreyfus is being totally driven insane, more and more insane as the film goes on. And you mentioned Shot in the Dark and Pink Panther Strikes Again earlier, and those are my two favorites as well. I would say that Shot in the Dark is the best film, and the Pink Panther Strikes Again is probably the funniest.
I agree with you. Yeah.
Because the script is really well constructed in Shot. It's very dark, it's very cynical, but it's very funny, and it introduces the character of Clouseau at the beginning and doesn't hold back in terms of his idiocy, and you can feel the developments of what they're discovering from him as they go on. Even the whole mispronunciation thing doesn't really take full bloom until late in the movie. But that's okay. It's just like it is, you're watching all of this blossom as the film
Yeah,
progresses.
it's the better structured of the two. It's tighter crafted. What was interesting is when I was watching Strikes Again, which is the one I watched the most, there's I think one of the funniest sequences in the entire series is when he interrogates the staff. We'll get to that. But when I was watching that, I thought this could have been easily right out of A Shot in the Dark, essentially. So there's kind of this little bridge there between the two films that they both kind of take this Hercule Poirot approach of him, dealing with the rich. I was noticing too with him in the trench coat and people looking down on him or underestimating him, obviously for good reason in these because he's bumbling and he kind of just stumbles into things. But I thought, my goodness, it's a little like the Columbo development. He's the serious one that people underestimate too, who's kind of sloppy and whatever. But he's not as bumbling. He's sharper, obviously, and than Clouseau by a mile. But anyway, I was noticing that this time around. I think A Shot in the Dark, it has some really great moments. That opening sequence, like, it feels like a stage play. Like, you can see maybe that was in the original. I do not know. I know math out left because they kept changing it or they were altering it way too much. I find it interesting that Sophia Loren and Walter Matthau were going to be in something together way back because they wound up being in Grumpier Old Men, and that was fascinating. I love that movie. But I think A Shot in the Dark, Alki Summer, so good. I love Cato. When I was watching it this time around, I mean, I always enjoyed Herbert Lom, but I was realizing he's kind of the stealthy secret MVP. Even the scenes he has with Peter Sellers, I think Sellers is generous here because he knows how funny Herbert Lom is. I feel like he actually steals those scenes. We're watching that eye twitch and we're watching the hee-hee, that thing he does, which is so funny because he has this sort of like baritone otherwise. It's very, trembly and nice and kind of sexy if he was in a different movie. But in this, the way he uses that and it drives him, increasingly mad is just so funny. Everyone has a coworker that they can't stand, and of course this is the extreme, so I love that.
And Lama's brilliant. In
Yeah.
some ways, for me, watching these again, his best stuff is when he's with Sellers
Yeah.
in scenes,
Yep.
which for reasons of plot, he can't always be with Sellers in scenes. But him screaming at him in this movie, he's really good. All he's fantastic even without Sellers in scenes. He's real. I always enjoy
Yeah.
Watching him play off of Andre Maron, who I didn't mention, but this is his first film in the series as well. He's a very good straight man in these movies,
Yes.
showing his exasperation to what's going on. But Lam, and Lam, again, Lam's realization of trying to maintain his sanity and worried that what if Clouseau is right? His terror is palpable, and there's almost more weight to it in this film because it's not part of a series or anything. He's playing it so deadly seriously. And it's so funny because of that.
Yes.
And Lum is a secret weapon. I mean, number of the other people basically have to be straight men in this film. Mm-hmm. You know, like George Sanders and that sort of thing. But, you know, Lum is playing a part who you would think is just a straight man, but it's much, much more than that. And
yes.
He
As
does
people keep him. Dying. Oh my God.
Yes. Yes, yes,
yes. Yeah.
So he is phenomenal and he continues to be phenomenal. And yes, I really like Elke Sommer in the movie as well.
Yes, and Cato is one of my favorite. Of course, watching it in 2025, you cringe every time he calls him, you know, his little yellow friend. But at the same time, it's just so funny with Cato because, you know, Cato knows how ridiculous he is, but they have this wonderful dynamic if it's been a while, where Cato will just come out and attack him because that's what he wants to do to keep himself, you know, fresh and on the edge, ready for anything in his
yes.
position. And so just he has to come up with ways to attack his employer. But then if the phone rings, he has to go back into like manservant
yeah.
or butler mode for him.
Yeah.
It's so funny. Yeah.
You imagine Clouseau laying down the rules. Whenever the phone rings, no matter what, the phone is most important.
Yeah.
The issue of certain things in Blake Edwards movies, it's kind of unavoidable. Some of the Cato stuff is...
Yeah, you know, exactly.
Things.
Little cringe.
Yes.
Real quick was you brought up, like we were talking about that phone in... Obviously, Mike Myers is a huge fan of these. I mean, Austin Powers and some, you know, this era of James Bond and Pink Panther, some of the jokes and some of the gags wind up in there. But in Wayne's World 2, there's a fight scene involving Tia Carrere's dad. There's like with his dad or her dad and, you know, like, you can't have my daughter. And they get into this ridiculous fight scene and the phone rings and they have to take a break. And like answer the phone. I'm sorry, I have call waiting. And so you can kind of tell like they took that right from these movies. But yes, I interrupted you, but yeah, about some of the Blake Edwards, especially like the party and, you know, some of that you have to kind of just overlook, but God, they're so funny. Yeah.
I know they're so funny. I do wonder because it's not even that long ago that I saw screenings of The Party in revival houses. I'm not, Can that be done now? I don't know. I really don't know.
Yeah.
It's an open question.
It is. Depends on the audience. And yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's tough. I mean, I went to, I've gone to a few rep screenings in LA and I went to Live and Die in LA and people were treating it like a comedy. So you never know. Yeah. Yeah.
I got the feeling, maybe this is just me, but I got the feeling that for a while, the Panther films were sort of perennials, and that sort of seems to be going, have gone away in recent years. Maybe comedy is more difficult to translate to new generations. I don't know.
That could be, yeah, because I was noticing when, you know, you go in and you start reading, God, Letterboxd reviews of some of these movies and they just focus on some aspect of the comedy that they don't like, you know, David Niven. Oh, even in the Wikipedia entry for Pink Panther, he's old enough to be her father, you know, is in the summary of the plot. And so, yeah, it's tough sometimes watching, you know, we grew up, you and I, watching these movies, classic films, and understanding they were, you know, part of this era and people have changed. That's great. But yeah, it's tough.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a question.
If Panther movies play at the New Beverly, I'm going to have to go and check out to see what happens.
Okay, we're giving him an assignment and we're going to follow up. No.
Okay.
I'm just kidding. I don't like to give homework, Peter. But yeah, no, A Shot in the Dark is so much fun. By the time they get to the, you know, the nudist area. That's hilarious. It's amazing that they got away with that the way they did, but it kind of sets up the movies that would come from Blake Edwards. So I think it's good. He does like, some naughtiness, which, I mean, his wife Julie Andrews took part just as much. And I think she probably enjoyed that. Like, hey everyone, I'm not Mary Poppins. Yes.
And when the film moves into its climax of the gathering of the suspects,
yes,
type thing, which is, I think, just a brilliant, brilliant scene in terms of how they're playing off him. And then when the movie basically, it's like the movie basically devolves into just the characters screaming at each other to the point where Clouseau even turns and looks at us in total frustration that he's been robbed of his moment of glory.
His Poirot Agatha Christie moment.
Exactly.
Turns into Jerry Springer. Yeah.
That's right. So, and that just feels perfect, that a movie that begins and plays out as something with just such careful construction that basically just all blows up. Well, literally, actually, in the very end, which is perfect for this movie that is just a Clouseau movie. It doesn't end elegantly. It ends with people screaming and falling into water.
Exactly. Yep. It's perfect for this, for sure.
Yes.
And I also love how Pink Panther, like the first one, we didn't even talk about the name of the series. It confuses people because there's a diamond and the flaw is, it looks jumping Pink Panther in the middle. And how some of these movies don't even involve a diamond or anything, but they're still Pink Panther. It becomes synonymous with Clouseau, this sort of diamond in the rough, or the flaw in the perfection of everything else. You have this guy. Yeah.
Hey, the Thin Man was only a character in the first film of that series. So.
I know. Yeah. Perfect.
This is what happens when you have an accidental movie series, basically.
Exactly.
It all works.
It does. Yeah. And then we just look at, you know, Loy and Powell and we think Thin Man, even though it's like, yep, where's the Thin Man? Don't really care. Where's the Pink Panther Diamond? Are we still talking about that? Elke Sommer might have whacked some people. Yeah. So I love that. Yeah. I would say the one after this, the reason to watch for me, probably Herbert Lom. There's some good Clouseau stuff, some Cato, but it isn't what that was. Return, correct? Is that the next one?
Return. Return came out in the summer of 75. Okay. So that's about an 11-year break.
Yeah.
And Return, which is basically, okay, well, first of all, when we get into Return, we get into a whole thing where we didn't really get into this, but this is a film series where so little connects on any kind of rational
level. Oh my goodness, I know.
It's like things do not really line up from one movie to the other. Even when the movie is a direct continuation, things don't line up. Characters return, actors return playing different characters, characters return played by different actors, somebody gets filled in one, they turn up in another. There is no real, the continuity cannot be justified. There's no way to do it. It's just impossible.
If you're one of those people, like the cinema sins people, if you're like plotting out, well, this can't happen, and looking, first of all, don't be watching comedies, but also don't be watching movies, but don't be watching the Pink Panther looking for logic. Like even the movie itself, one single film, very little of it sometimes makes sense, especially Strikes Again, which I think is hilarious. It's more like a James Bond spoof, but you know, does it make any sense? Not really. Who cares? Yeah.
When both Pink Panther and Shot in the Dark, not saying they're perfect, but they feel very deliberately constructed.
Yes.
Throughout. When we get into the later sequels, that becomes more of a
freewheeling.
Yeah, a little bit. You see, Return of the Pink Panther has some brilliant things in it. Especially, I love when, you know, Herbert Lom screaming at Clouseau to get out of his office.
Oh
is
my
up
gosh.
There.
Yes.
There are also things like, you know, Clouseau arriving in Switzerland. And it's like one of those, it's that weird thing of the series where, you know, Dreyfus is part of the real world and he gets driven insane by Clouseau. Clouseau, meanwhile, is so in his own head and like believes in his own genius. And he himself is constantly being driven insane by the outside world in ways that make no sense. Mm-hmm. So, you know, him looking at the camera at the end of the shot in the dark, him arriving in Switzerland in Return of the Pink Panther and saying, follow that car. So the cab driver gets out of the car and runs after the car, to which that he is continually exasperated by these peons who he is so much more brilliant than are baffling him. Mm-hmm. But Return of the Pink Panther starts off in a way that feels very tightly constructed. We find out about the panther. We're reacquainted with that. We see it get stolen. We see Clouseau in assigned to the case. We see Sir Charles Lytton, now played by Christopher Plummer instead of David Niven, who seems to be married to somebody else entirely. He is being accused, so he sets off to find out what's going on his own. All of this makes sense. All of this seems like the setup of a film.
Yeah.
But forward momentum in the plot seems to stop at some point or another. Around the second hour where it starts to feel like nothing is really happening. Watching the movies this time around, I was very conscious that there are times where Clouseau is in a scene and it's moving the plot forward. There are times like in Return when he's in Catherine Schell as Christopher Plummer's wife, he's in her hotel room getting involved in all sorts of chaos. It's like a Laura in the middle of the movie. And it's very funny, but that is also the point where I start to get a little worn down because nothing really moving forward. Maybe that's a me problem. I don't know.
No, I agree with you. Yeah. Some of it is a little, static. Yep.
That does sort of happen. So what is to me the hysteria of the first half is not necessarily sustained. You know, it's a 110-minute movie that maybe could have been 95 minutes. I'm never as crazy when we cut back to Christopher Plummer. It feels like it always makes me think of like a musical number in a Marx Brothers movie or something where it's letting us take a break from the laughter for a few minutes. And I wish it were a little bit more enjoyable because I like Plummer, but
yeah,
this stuff
too.
Never really does much for me.
No, I'm with you. Yeah.
You know, he's playing the same character as David Niven, but he doesn't really feel like the same guy. So that is another one of those Panther films, that Panther things that you just have to accept. Yep. You just have to go with. The movie has great stuff in it, but it's more of a parts greater than the whole sort of thing.
I am absolutely with you on that. And especially when you know like Christopher Plummer's career, and he's just, there's something a little craftier and a little sneakier. It's a different take on the character, a different thing. Yeah, this one doesn't fully work for me, but like I say, it's really Cato and Herbert Lom, especially. I think that's when I kind of wrote like an ode to Herbert Lom, was by the time I reached this movie, because it was this, I think, the same scene, the one where he's screaming to get out of the office there, is just so damn good. Yeah.
The movie is not that I was around in 1975 to watch this or anything, but, you know, Herbert Lom is basically opening the movie at, you know, at the top, at the ceiling, as opposed to A Shot in the Dark where he started as a normal person and then, you know, went to 11 from there. He starts at 11 in Return of the Pink Panther. He starts screaming at him, which is itself hysterically funny. And it's almost like the movie... It's almost like the movie in that pre-people watching movies at home way. It's like the movie is a sequel to people's memories of the Pink Panther and A Shot in the Dark. You know,
I agree.
That was a different time where they didn't have to worry about certain plot specifics. People just remembered that the movie was about Herbert Lom yelling at Peter Sellers. So they make that sequel, and that's how this movie opens. That's fine. That's fine. This is all fiction. These are just movies. It's just make believe. If it's funny, that's A-okay with me. It's funny to look at it that way, that the idea that the movie is almost more of a sequel to the memory of a movie than the actual movie, but that's fine. Mm-hmm. That's fine. You know, as long as it's Blake Edwards, watching these movies, you know, Blake Edwards needed a movie to be a hit at this point. And maybe that is part of the reason why there's so much of the Christopher Plummer stuff, because, you know, it gives people the chance to see action and romance and derring do and that sort of thing. So he's trying to make a movie for everybody, which is also okay. There are times through these movies where even though you can sense Blake Edwards' personal preoccupations, you know, the worlds these movies are set in, there is always in each of them, you know, the confusion between men and women, and men dressed up as women, women dressed up as men. Mm-hmm. And it continued after the Panther movies. So they all, I think that's part of what interested me when I was much younger, that I sensed these movies being made by
the
one
same
person.
Yep.
Whether they were dramas or comedies, there were similarities between them. There were continued interests between them. And, you know, the Pink Panther series at this point in time in the 70s, they were, you know, they were meant to be hits. They were commercial comedies. And by the time we get to the Pink Panther Strikes Again, it's clear that it really feels like Blake Edwards wants to put everything he's got, every idea he has related to Clouseau or anything like that, into one movie. And to make the biggest, most elaborate movie he can. This kind of goes back to what I was saying about scenes that just kind of go on and on without, like, plot reasons.
Yes.
Because that does happen again in Strikes Again. And the original cut of Strikes Again was considerably longer. That's how they previewed the movie, and then they cut it down. And some of these scenes got used in another movie some years down the line. The Pink Panther Strikes Again feels choppy at times because of this. That's fine. The laughs are what are most important. Because the scene you mentioned from Strikes Again, mm-hmm. which recalls, you know, Clouseau interrogating everyone in the household, it very much recalls the scene of Shot in the Dark, and it is hysterically funny. It is painfully funny. Absolutely. But every time I watch a shot, the Strikes Again, and this scene comes up, part of me is like, wait, well, why is Clouseau here again? What's going on? And, you know, I remember, oh, wait, there's this professor who got kidnapped. But wait, why is Clouseau investigating this? I don't remember. And I think this is not that big a criticism I'm making. I'm just sort of saying that the plot mechanics are not necessarily the most important thing in Strikes Again.
Not at all. And I like what you were saying about a film being a sequel to your memories, which is kind of what Return is. Because when I think of my memories of Pink Panther and the series, I'm thinking of the stuff that happens in Strikes Again. So I hadn't watched the entire series together in a number of years. And so I'd forgotten just how many wild swings the series takes as it's finds itself, and it realizes, okay, what they had in Clouseau and Sellers, and also just shaping it and, you know, getting that core ensemble together. It started as an ensemble movie, but that ensemble fades away, and then they build their own with those actors. And I think, yes, so it feels like a sequel, I guess, to my memories. So I loved mm-hmm. your phrasing on that, Peter. And yeah, Strikes Again, the one I watched the most, definitely just fall down laughing. Oh my gosh.
Yes.
Yes. And
yes,
you know, it's the production of two people who are just creative geniuses, probably very unwieldy, hard to handle. Actors all have big personalities. Peter Sellers, you know, could have like 25 moods in a day. And so scenes are going to change. The tone is going to change. Yeah, I think you're right. The first two films are just classically structured. They stand on their own more as films. But if you're thinking of the Pink Panther as kind of the silly thing, that is what Strikes Again does. And it's, you know, the perfect example of that. Yes.
The film is insane.
It is. Absolutely. It's a James Bond spoof, kind of.
It's a James Bond spoof, but it's got science fiction stuff. And,
yes. You know, yeah.
The opening shot of the movie is of the asylum where Dreyfus is, and there's a sign saying psychiatric hospital. So it's basic. The movie is basically announcing that this movie is an insane asylum.
Yes.
There's a little bit of James Bond stuff, even to the point of there's like plot stuff happening involving a crook escaping from custody and back and forth with like bank robberies. And it feels like something out of a James Bond movie, actually,
yeah.
Where you are hearing about like a villain's plan coming together or something like that. It's all madness, yet somehow, unlike Return of the Pink Panther, there is this weird thing of forward momentum that keeps it going. And at times being hysterically funny. And, you know, Herbert Lom was such a good actor. He's great. And there's so many movies of his from like the 40s that I've never seen, but you know, he's great in Night in the City back in the 50s. I like him in Gambit in the 60s. He's fantastic in The Dead Zone. And you know, he was such a serious actor who found his biggest fame in a comic role. And I'd like to hope that he took pleasure from that.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's great to see him get so much of center stage in Strikes Again. He plays an organ, which is a little bit like he starred in the Hammer version of Phantom of the Opera. I don't know if that's a reference, but it's fun to see him doing things like that. The actor Graham Stark, who is a friend of Peter Sellers, has a different role in like each movie.
Yeah.
He plays Herman, Shot in the Dark. In Strikes Again, he plays a hotel clerk in the famous That Is Not My Dog scene. He wrote a book, actually, about his friendship with Peter Sellers called Remembering Peter Sellers. It's a very light, conversational sort of thing. The Panther movies come up in it. He writes about how originally he was going to play another desk clerk in Germany. And if you think this will make sense, if you think of what Graham Stark looks like, Blake Edwards' idea for it was that he would have a little Hitler mustache so that he would look exactly like Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
So they did this, and then Sellers could never get through a take without bursting into hysterics. They tried. They never got a usable take. I'm pretty sure you still see the back of his head in the German hotel lobby sequences, like handing Clouseau a key for his room. But according to Stark in his book, they never got a usable take. So finally, Edwards is like, okay, we'll find something else for you to do in the movie. And so they had him play the other desk clerk. And that's where that is not my dog thing came from. It's a hysterically funny movie at times. It really is. It really is. And it does feel like this sort of high point because it could not get more insane than that. And you feel Edward's continuous invention. One thing I haven't mentioned yet is that I love Edwards was a very cinematic director, and I love the way he would play out scenes in one in a kind of proscenium arch kind of way. If you look at like a scene where Herbert Lom is talking to his psychiatrist and he's just kind of walking around the room into close up over to a window,
yes,
hitting about a dozen marks in the scene, and Lom is brilliant in the scene. And Edwards just has the confidence to have the actors play out things together in this one shot. And then there will be some sort of abrupt cut to an explosion, or an explosion and an abrupt cut to something else. And all of this would feel very deliberate, and you would feel Edwards' hand assembling all of this together. So that's just one of those things that I always enjoy in his films, that you feel his craft in there. Yeah. And Strikes Again feels like this stylistic high point.
It really does.
Yeah.
They know finally what they have when Lom and Sellers play off of each other. And also you can't help but think about what it was probably like. They might have been playing a little bit like Blake Edwards versus Peter Sellers through this relationship on screen, which I love so much. Like by the lake at the beginning at the psychiatric, just, you know, like, oh, I'm fine now. No, he's not. Yes.
There is a point in the series, and I'm not really sure when, where Dreyfus very much does become like a sort of avatar for Edwards.
Okay.
In trying to deal with this thing. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I was going to mention that, but
yeah.
I also have a fondness in Pink Panther movies when there's an explosion and they cut to Clouseau or somebody back in the police station and he's still wearing the clothes he was wearing and the clothes are smoking and stuff. all good. And just
Inspector Gadget kind of took from
yes,
a bit.
Yes.
Yeah.
And whenever Clouseau will say something like boom and the other person will say boom and Clouseau will say what?
Oh, I know.
That never fails.
Like, what are you talking about?
Never fails.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. So if you want to continue, I watched Revenge and that's where I stopped. But yeah, let's go from there.
Okay. Well, I know you did not appear to like Revenge that much, but that's okay. That's okay.
I like aspects of Revenge. Yeah. I like, there are sequences in Revenge I like, but no, that one does not work for me.
Revenge, I do like it, but I understand. I also have very strong memories of Revenge because weirdly enough, when I was a kid, I had the photo novel.
Gotcha.
So they did a photo novel for Revenge of the Pink Panther. So in some ways, I almost have stronger memories of Revenge from a kid. Than
again,
any of
we're talking about the memories of the series. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. What Revenge feels a little bit like is, you know, it feels a little bit like Edwards put all of his ideas into Strikes Again, and then it was like, okay, we need one more. You need one more? Okay, I guess I'll come up with, you know, it's a plot that makes sense, you know, after everyone tries to kill Clouseau, and this one, people think Clouseau is actually dead. It does have some funny things in it. It does have some things I like in it. It says something that I was watching it the other day, and throughout Return and Strikes Again, there are all these tangents the movies go off to. In Revenge of the Pink Panther, practically every scene is about the plot.
Yes.
Except for when Clouseau comes home and is looking for Cato, everything is about it. Everything is plot oriented.
I know.
Clouseau's in a disguise, it's to get information so we can go to the next scene.
Yeah, it's trying to explain too much. It's a bunch of exposition. Yeah. It's Clouseau in the middle of like a French Connection plot. It's very weird. Yes.
The plot is basically Robert Weber is the head of the French mafia or whatever. And he New York seems to feel that he's not living up to his end of the bargain. So to show that he can get the job done, he arranges to have Clouseau killed. Everyone in the world believes he succeeded. Clouseau is still alive, though, and basically stays undercover in secret to uncover what's gone on. And basically, every scene feels like it's plot. I'm not saying it's a good plot. I'm not saying these are good scenes. But basically, it's like on index cards, one scene leads to the next. And, you know, Lam is more of a supporting role in this. He doesn't really get to interact with Clouseau that much unless he sees him and then immediately faints. I don't dislike the movie, but it does feel like it's a more modest scale kind of film.
Yeah.
Do you have any further comments on it or?
No, I like Diane Cannon.
I like Diane Cannon. Yeah, she's
I thought she was great. But yeah, this movie, it kind of feels like by this point, they know, like, they're just kind of, I don't want to say they're phoning it in because they're still very, very funny, but they sort of know those heydays are kind of behind them. And, you know, they're getting close. They're both, I think this relationship is wearing on them, and we can kind of tell.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
In his book, Graham Stark writes that, who's in this movie, he plays Professor Balls. He writes that he actually went along to Hong Kong for no reason because he's not in that section of the movie. They just invited him. He's like, okay, I'll go. And they landed in Hong Kong to torrential downpours. And they didn't know what they were going to do. And suddenly Edwards wondered what the weather was like in Rio right then. So they started to look into it. And maybe for a few hours, they were going to go to Rio to shoot the last half hour of the movie. And that wound up not happening. But I think that says right there that the plotting in these movies were, you know, the approach could be very loosey-goosey, I guess you could say.
Yeah, Adam Sandler's talked about that. Like, he sets movies where he wants to go on vacation because, you know, you're going to be there for a couple months or 30 days mm-hmm. to a few months, bring the family, and it's where everybody wants to go. So they figured it out. He just kind of said the secret part out loud, essentially. Yeah. And so that's always been movie making 101, especially when you're making movies with people you know, and you know you kind of have the ability to do that. Those days are changing now, except for kind of a chosen few filmmakers. Yeah. But yeah, absolutely. So after this, there were a few films.
Yeah, I just want to mention about the end of the movie, though, if I could.
Go for it.
The end of the movie, basically, after everything is settled, the final scene is Clouseau picking up Diane Cannon for a date.
Yes.
And then his car doesn't work, and they sort of went walking down the street. And the scene, like, reminds me of the end of The Party, where Sellers drops off Claudine Leger at her apartment. Both scenes are sort of quiet street in front of an apartment building. There's no real final gag. This is, like, I guess the one Panther movie where there's no real final gag in the movie.
Yeah.
And it's a nice odd moment. Maybe you could read into it that it's basically saying Edwards and Sellers are both done with this.
And he's going to be okay. Yep.
It's going to be okay. Let's walk off and have a nice dinner.
Yes.
This is over now.
Yeah.
And it's a nice moment. And then they never made another Panther movie again. Oh, wait. okay. So basically... Yeah. Sellers and Edwards were not speaking.
No.
And Sellers was going to make his own Panther movie. He had written with someone else a film called Romance of the Pink Panther. And this movie was going to get made. It is dated, literally, the script I have of it is dated literally days before he passed.
Mm-hmm.
So this movie never happened. And for whatever reason, United Artists wanted to try to keep this going somehow.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure.
I suppose Edwards was making a lot of money off of this.
Yeah.
And maybe there was something in him that wanted to prove to the world that he was the creative force behind the series as opposed to Sellers, even though the world probably knew Peter Sellers in 1979 much more than they knew Blake Edwards. Anyway, so Trail of the Pink Panther, which is a genuinely strange movie. I mentioned it on Blue Sky the other day, and I got multiple tweets that were like, that movie is so bizarre.
it really is, yeah.
It basically has a threadbare plot. It basically utilizes three things. Utilizes outtakes of Sellers, all from Strikes Again. There are clips from earlier Panther movies.
Yeah.
And incidentally, I could believe that somebody.
It's a clip show. Yeah.
It's a clip show. It's a clip. You paid money in 1982 to go see a clip show.
Yep.
And I could believe that there are people of a certain age who know these movies, and they've all blended together partly because of the clips in this movie.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah.
Again, looking back and thinking that the whole series is one thing because you saw them all together mixed in. Mm-hmm.
There's new footage. There's a threadbare plot involving the Panther Diamond being stolen again. Clouseau is assigned. Meanwhile, we have Dreyfus railing to a psychiatrist about Clouseau. Clouseau's plane disappears about the halfway mark, so there's no more new Sellers footage.
Mm-hmm.
And all the Sellers footage is basically, some of it's fine, but it's so, like, isolated.
Yeah,
it's not about it's isolated. It's just we're seeing DVD extras before DVDs.
Yeah.
And then a reporter played by Joanna Lumley is investigating the disappearance of her Clouseau, of Clouseau. So she interviews David Niven, back this time as Sir Charles Lytton, Capucine. She interviews Graham Stark, and she gets mixed up with the mafia, who are upset that she's investigating Clouseau, because maybe Clouseau will come back and cause trouble. And none of this plot has anything to do with anything.
Yeah.
It's like, can we get this to 90 minutes?
I know. And the film, I mean, Blake Edwards, I think it was two reasons. He wanted to do something to honor Peter Sellers, probably looking back. And, you know, it helps him. It's also, it's a tribute to what they did, but it's also money in his pocket, and he's making other movies. The film, Sellers' Widow, did sue Blake Edwards and was it MGM? I can't remember, but she did.
It was
sue.
UA, probably.
Okay,
it was
UA. Yes, yeah. So it's was there another one, thing, one in this era? I can't remember.
Well, I'm going to get to that, but one thing I'll say about Edwards is, one thing I've never really read this, but you know, Edwards was kind of a high at this point. You know, 10 SOB Victor.
He really
Victoria.
Was Victor Victoria. Yeah.
And three of his most acclaimed movies. And he worked, I'm still impressed by how much he worked in the 90s, in the 80s rather.
Yeah.
And there are movies in there that I still like. But that's another subject. But I would almost make the argument that his critical reputation was never quite the same after these early 80s Panther movies that he tried. Mm-hmm. And I would just basically say that they were a mistake for him to make. And I say that even though the immediate follow-up, Curse of the Pink Panther, is a movie I like. Both Trail and Curse were basically made together as one movie and then released separately. Curse of the Pink Panther is basically Clouseau is still missing.
Yes.
They decide to program a computer to find the world's greatest detective to find Clouseau. Dreyfus programs the computer secretly so that it will find the world's worst detective, and the computer gives them a New York cop played by Ted Wass. And it's not even that I'm that crazy about Ted Wass, but I feel like the movie has a nice energy to it, and the plotting all kind of goes together, and it just, something about it works for me, and I know I can't defend it. But I will call it a surprisingly good movie, even though it doesn't really need to exist.
Which one I remember seeing, but I saw it probably around the time it came out, so I have no memory if it was good, was Roberto Benigni in Son of the Pink Panther. Did you see that
which
one?
Which I was going to get to, yeah.
You're like, Jen, you're speeding through these.
That's okay. That's okay.
I should explain to those listening that I've been having internet hiccups. So I'm like, Peter is so brilliant. I'm like, we have to get all of Peter's wonderful articulations. Yes.
Son of the Pink Panther came 10 years later. If they had just made Son of the Pink Panther, maybe commercially that would have been like a little bit more acceptable, because it wasn't trying to capitalize on someone who had recently died. The only thing is, it's Son of the Pink Panther interests me. I'm not saying it's a good movie, but it interests me. Mm-hmm. Have you seen it recently?
No, I would have seen it probably like on video around the time it came out.
It's Edward's last movie, and that automatically makes it interesting.
Yes.
It's Edward's last movie. It's Henry Mancini's last score. We haven't talked about Mancini. I'm going to get to
it. Oh, my gosh. I love the Mancini scores.
Yeah. The movie just feels like it. It's a decent idea. Basically, Dreyfus discovers a young cop in Nice who reminds him of Clouseau, and it turns out that he is in fact the son of Clouseau, and his mother is Maria Gambrelli from A Shot in the Dark, this time played by Claudia Cardinale from The Pink Panther, even though she doesn't really seem like the same character anyway.
Mm-hmm. Again, they keep changing. Yes.
They keep changing. Well, we should also go, you know, back in the Trail Curse thing, you know, Joanna Lumley is the reporter in Trail, and she's also a completely different character in Curse. Curse also, to go back to it, has a very now infamous cameo at the end of the movie by a very famous movie star. That is a very funny thing to see. And if there's anyone out there who hasn't seen the film yet. I don't want to spoil it, but it is worth seeing.
Okay.
Going back to Sun, the problem is the movie is 90 minutes. It feels like it was edited with a hatchet. There's no real energy to it. Edwards directs scenes in his, you know, in his one-er way, through, you know, all one shot. And there doesn't really feel like there's much energy to it a lot of the time. It's got a plot involving a Lugash princess. Lugash is the Middle Eastern country that runs all through these movies, which we didn't mention. But a Lugash princess who's been kidnapped. This young, the young son of Clouseau, Jacques Gambrelli, played by Roberto Benigni, is in love with her and is seeking her out. And the plot doesn't really, there's not really much to the plot. Maybe they needed to bring the diamond back into it again to do something. There's not much energy. There's not much plot. Way too much of the movie is set in a hospital, and that's kind of depressing. Whatever you feel about Benigni, he has energy, but he's kind of off in his own world.
He's in a different movie, basically. I remember that.
Or at least his own movie, I guess.
That's what I mean. Yeah. Like, he's creating his own thing. It's a tribute, but it's different. Yeah.
Yeah, the movie interests me partly because Herbert Lahm as Dreyfus feels like he's more of an avatar for Blake Edwards than ever before. He's not really a villain in this movie. He's more curious about Gambrelli before he finds out who he is than anything. And it's as if the movie is about Dreyfus trying to come to terms with this madman. And that is interesting to me. I'm not saying it's good, but there's something there. And it is this sort of old man kind of movie, to use the parlance of Karina Longworth's podcast right now.
Yes.
That if you have an interest and affection for the director's body of work, you will find something.
Yeah. Like Avanti for Billy Wilder. I still enjoy that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I wish Sun were better. I wish it had more energy to it. I wish the plot came together more. There's like plot machinations in the movie that never really develop into anything.
Yes.
And I think it's too bad. I would like to know what's missing. I've always kind of wondered. Brooke Kwok is in it again. It's Cato. Graham Stark plays Professor Balls again. Andre Maron is not in this movie, even though he was still alive at the time, possibly retired. I've always kind of wondered about that. I'm still interested in the movie. I was watching some of it the other night. It's not something I can recommend unless you have an interest in it.
Yes.
That's what I would say.
Unless you're going down that rabbit hole. Yes.
Exactly, which I've done plenty of times.
Oh my goodness, me too. Yeah.
And even, I don't even like the opening title sequence in the movie, which is Bobby McFerrin doing a Pink Panther cover. I wish it were just straight Edwards. I mean, Mancini, I should say.
Yeah,
it's Mancini's final score. It has some nice stuff in it. I love Mancini in general. I love Henry Mancini's scores for Blake Edwards. I love Henry Mancini's scores for Pink Panther movie. I'd love to have a party someday where the entire music playlist is just background Henry Mancini background music from Pink Panther movies.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
I think he was a master doing this. Because there is not music in Blake Edwards movies when people fall down. It's not like a Mickey Mouse and kind of thing. It's just like this light sort of Henry Mancini thematics that are just kind of playing through it. At a certain point in the movie, in the series, they introduce a secondary Inspector Clouseau theme. That's not the Pink Panther theme. It's just a light sort of dun, 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 dun. And it's, you know, James Bond got a secondary theme at one point in that series as well. So there's another thing that kind of connects the two series together. And I can listen to Henry Mancini Pink Panther themes all day.
So classy, and so beautiful.
And that basically was Edwards' final film, unfortunately. And We don't need to talk about the Steve Martin movies.
Oh, no. Or the
To,
idea
to...
that maybe Eddie Murphy is going to pick up the mantle. It's like, guys, stop it. Yes.
I know, I know. I.
And yeah, that's kind of the end of those. And I know as far as Blake Edwards goes, you're a big fan. We've talked and touched on some of his other movies you love, like 10 and SOB. I'd recommend Victor Victoria, other ones. Are there any you want to give a quick shout out to before I let you go? Oh, The Party, of course.
Oh,
Yes.
there's The Party, there's The 10, there's SOB, there's Victor Victoria. Something like his latest Switch, which came 2 years before Son of the Pink Panther, has a fantastic Ellen Barkin performance.
I was going to say Barkin was great. Yes.
Barkin was great. His John Ritter movie, Skin Deep, which began life as a sequel to 10, has some interesting things in it. And even going back to the 60s, there's, right before the Pink Panther, he did Experiment in Terror and Days of Wine and Roses, which are very different films. One a thriller, one an extremely downbeat drama about alcoholism, but they're both excellent films. And it still fascinates me the wide range of genres he explored while still showing, his interests in what he wanted to explore in these things. There's a pretty good movie called The Carrie Treatment with James Coburn that I think he kind of disowned because MGM took it away from him, but it's a kind of a totally decent murder mystery. That's from the early 70s. And one of the ones not scored by Henry Mancini. But yeah, I'm
It's
always
a
fascinated.
worthwhile, filmography.
I'll freely admit that I was reading over a few Blake Edwards books that I have, and
Oh, that's
in
great,
preparation
Peter.
for this. And I'm not going to mention the books because I honestly feel like the really good Blake Edwards book has still yet to be written. But that's just me.
Maybe it should be written by Peter Avellino. You're a brilliant writer, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you, Jen. Thank you for saying that. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you so much for doing this. I always learn a lot when I talk to you. Plus, it's a lot of fun. You're a great pal. So, Peter, you are welcome
Thank you.
back anytime you would like, my friend. And I think, next time I'm in LA, let's hit another movie. Let's hope maybe we're going to get a Blake Edwards or a Peter Sellers movie.
That would be great to get together, whether it's Blake Edwards or not. That would be fantastic.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jen.
I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as a dollar per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more, by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching. This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.